Hello and welcome to Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and today I'm joined by Professor Michael Littman to discuss reinforcement learning, the other type of machine learning. Michael is an award-winning professor of computer science at Brown University, specializing in reinforcement learning. Is co-creator of the machine learning and reinforcement learning courses offered as part of Georgia Tech's Online Master of Science in Computer Science, or OMSCS program, and is currently serving as Division Director for Information and Intelligence Systems at the US National Science Foundation. He is also the author of the soon-to-be-released Code to Joy, Why Everyone Should Learn a Little Programming. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
In addition to all the things I've just mentioned, Michael, you are also probably the only guest I've ever had on this podcast who has appeared in a music video.
That's interesting. Now, keep in mind, this was a music video that was on YouTube, so that's not an incredibly high bar to get onto a music video on YouTube.
Ah, but it's a good video. Okay. So for anyone who hasn't seen it, Michael and Professor Charles Isbell made a music video several years back where they sing about overfitting machine learning models to the tune of Thriller by Michael Jackson. And I believe there's also a second video where you sing about K-means clustering to Smoking Out the Window.
That's exactly right.
I've seen parts of that one, but for my money, the Thriller video is the way to go.
The Thriller video has definitely gotten the most airplay of anything that I've ever posted. We had a team at Georgia Tech who did the production and who did the background singing, and it was really high quality stuff. So plus, I mean, machine learning is kind of a big thing now. And so there's lots of people who are just starting to learn about it. And sometimes they want to take a little break from all the equation cramming and just see something a little bit different. And so we get some play.
And I think that probably makes you and Charles Isbell the coolest machine learning lecturers on the face of the planet.
Well, thanks so much. So I made a presentation in a conference a number of years ago, I guess in 2016. And I was introduced by a real luminary in the field of machine learning, a guy named Tom Dietrich, who introduced me as the funniest person in machine learning. And I thought that was a very nice thing to say. But then afterwards, I saw him at the refreshments afterwards. And he said, "I just want to tell you, you're actually number two. Charles is number one." And so I'm like, okay, I'm okay being number two to Charles. Charles is a very, very funny guy.
Yeah. For the sake of listeners, I had the pleasure of taking two classes that were taught by Michael and Charles Isbell as part of Georgia Tech's OMSCS program. And one of the students in one of those classes described your lectures as being like watching a stand-up comedy act. And I think that is a perfect way of describing them. They are absolutely hilarious. And then you realize, oh yeah, I'm learning something as well.
Yeah, that's important too, right? If we were just funny, that would probably not fly. We'd lose our jobs as professors. But the fact of the matter is, we try, because this is how we think about the field. Like we've been studying this stuff for many years, and it's hard to take it super seriously. There's so much weirdness to it. There's so much quirkiness to it that, you know, you have to have a kind of good sense of humor about it sometimes.
And I can see just from the way you're talking about it right now that you're very enthusiastic about this subject and computer science in general. Where does all this enthusiasm come from?
You mean beyond the fact that computer science is like the coolest thing to study?
Well, yeah.
I mean, to me, that's the main thing. And this has been a recurring theme in my life. So I first got exposed to computing. I was 13 years old. It was 1979, let's say. And I had convinced my parents to get me a computer. And I sat in my room for basically 3 years, just like immersed in this thing because it was so compelling. And as I'm learning about this stuff, I have two younger siblings. I would go to them. I'm like, oh my gosh, you have to see this. It's the coolest thing ever. Like arrays blew my mind, just completely like rewrote my operating system code. It was just the coolest thing. And so I'm telling my younger siblings and they're looking at me like I had just sprouted tentacles out of my forehead. Like, what are you even talking about? First of all, I don't understand a word you're saying. And second of all, it doesn't sound interesting at all. And so at the time I decided, okay, the problem is I caught them too. They were too old. Like I need to catch them younger. So I waited, I bided my time. I finally had children, two children, almost like copies of my siblings. I had a younger sister and a younger brother. And then I had a daughter and a son. I'm like, this is it. This is it. Now I get to finally teach them about how exciting computing is. And they were very polite about it, but it did not move them the way that it moves me. And I finally realized, okay, wait, maybe this isn't a them thing. Maybe this is a me thing.
But the students that you're teaching, they must be very engaged in your classes because they would be on board.
That's interesting to say. Well, I do everything I can to keep people, yeah, kind of in the moment, in the subject, learning about this stuff. I've been teaching computer science for long enough that the student bodies shift over time. And so there were times like, say, in the early 2000s, when first of all, there was nobody in the classes. All the people who had been studying computer science all left because they were told, at least in the US, they were told, this is a dumb thing to study because all of the jobs are being outsourced. Only people in India are going to get to do, say, programming. Don't study this. That's stupid. And their parents would tell them that, and the kids would not study computer science. So the only people in the classes were people who were pretty diehard. Either they didn't get the memo, right? That nobody actually bothered to tell them this is not worth your time, or they actually were excited about the subject. And so that, you know, that was kind of fun because the people that were there in the classroom were really, really, really wanted to be there. Then, wow. I mean, over the course of 10, 15 years, I think the field grew, or the number of students in these classes grew tenfold, right? Like or at least threefold, but like more than one doubling. So possibly two doublings. And so suddenly there's tons of people who on paper anyway, wanted to study computer science. But in practice, I think a lot of them were in the field because they thought this is a good place to get a job. And so teaching them is more difficult, right? You actually do need to help people appreciate why they should be excited, why this does matter, why it would make a difference in their lives. Yeah, that's a, you know, like you stand up in the front of the classroom, you do absolutely everything you can to keep their attention.
One of the things I've been told, I'm not a fan of PowerPoint, but it seems to be required nowadays. And if I do it under duress and I put pictures on my slides. And I've been told that actually really appeals to the class, because I've been told a lot of lecturers put just words on the slides and that just having pictures there really makes a difference.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I think they're already processing all these words. A lot of times, just the choice of picture is revealing of the personality of the person who designed the slides. And so you're getting something much more human, right? You're kind of connecting with someone at a level that just the words doesn't really do the trick. And so yeah, I believe that. I mean, boy, I just went to a thesis defense this week, and the student was fantastic at producing visuals. He made a little sort of a little graphic robot that reappeared throughout the talk. And it was just, you know, it did different things. It had different expressions. It conveyed a lot of, like, I think it came to represent him in some ways. And it was really fun to just see what would be on the next slide. Right. So that kept me watching. Nowadays, it's really hard. I find that just for me, when I hear a talk, not going to email is a huge thing, because email is constantly trying to draw me back in, right? The siren song of the email. And as soon as I do that, I stop listening, and then I lose the thread, and then the whole thing was a waste of time. And so I have to try really hard to prevent myself from going down that road. And the pictures can be really helpful in preventing losing my attention.
So from your point of view as a teacher, what's the biggest tip you would give people on how to engage students?
Yeah, so I think it's what I tell, okay, what I often tell my students, my PhD students or master students, when they're about to give a presentation, is there's two things that everybody gets wrong. Like everybody gets more or less, I mean, unless they're not good at all, they're going to get the content right. They're going to get the details more or less right. They're going to get, it can be hard, but they're going to get the flow from topic to topic right. But they're often going to miss up two things. I say, pay attention to transitions. Like before you flip the slide, set up the next slide, because they need to know where they are and how they're getting to where they are next. the common error is you have a slide and you said you don't love PowerPoint. And I think this is the reason that some people don't love PowerPoint, because it convinces you that you talk, there's a slide up there, you talk about that slide, you pause, you advance the slide, and then you start the story of the next slide. And so it's a series of short stories instead of a narrative arc. And so if you force yourself before you change the slide to set up what they're going to see on the next slide so that they're ready for it, and then boom, it's there. That makes for I think, a smoother presentation. And then the second thing is visuals, because I think that's the other thing that people tend to do. They'll either just have slides of equations if it's a mathy talk, which that's really tough on the listener, like absorbing equations in real time while someone's talking, that's really rough. And words, they'll just have the wall of text that's just like bullet, 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 bullet. And so now, you know, the slide comes up and you're thinking, oh crap, I have to read all this and listen, and the language doesn't always match. And I have to try to, why do they put that bullet if they said that thing? That's exhausting. And so making sure that there's visuals that actually kind of take them through the story, that makes a really big difference. And it's time consuming, right? It's not easy to make visuals. Words, like you already know what you're going to say. So writing down the words is a piece of cake. But getting visuals that actually kind of help people understand what you're saying is extra work, but it's worth it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, I could happily discuss teaching advice with you all day, but that's not why our listeners are here. Our topic for today is actually reinforcement learning, which is the other type of machine learning.
Which every time you say that, it makes me think of, there was an old commercial in the US, maybe not that old. Eh, it's old. If I remember it, it's probably old, where they would be trying to sell pork and they would call it the other white meat. So there was chicken and then there's the other white meat. And that's when you see reinforcement learning is the other machine learning. I think, yeah, it's basically pork. And it's funny that you say it that way, because I used to teach a reinforcement learning class where I would get up in the beginning, students would come in, the very first lecture, I would say, you have to understand, I know you're interested in machine learning. This isn't the machine learning that you're thinking of. So, you know, this is, if you're wanting that kind of machine learning, you need to go to a different class. And I'd let, you know, give people a chance to leave if they need to leave. And then I would say, okay, now we're going to talk about the other kind of machine learning, reinforcement learning, which to me is the most interesting thing because it really embodies the entire AI problem. But from a practical standpoint, it's not been as influential as supervised machine learning. And so I, you know, want to make sure people understand that.
I was lucky enough to go to a university that had a course, a whole semester long course in reinforcement learning. But I know a lot of our listeners won't have been fortunate enough to have done that. For those people who've never encountered reinforcement learning before, can you explain what it is?
Yes, I should do that. In fact, I heard once a talk that was like an intro to data science talk where the person giving the talk, oh man, I hope I can remember the terms, said, you know, I think of supervised, unsupervised, and reinforcement learning as being the three main flavors of machine learning. But he said to a data science, it's actually like prospective, prospective, and anti, okay, I'm definitely making up words now. I forget how he described it, but it was, descriptive, proscriptive, and predictive. I think it might've been that. All right. So predictive is like supervised learning, where you're trying to predict the next thing when you're given this training data that consists of, well, this is when you're in this kind of situation, this is what you should predict. Descriptive is like unsupervised learning, where it just takes a whole lot of data and just tries to make some kind of sense of it. It's trying to describe it, right? And it takes very many different forms. But the idea in reinforcement learning, and this is why I think it's so important and compelling, is that we're actually going to use it to make decisions. We're actually going to prescribe a course of action based on the data. And that's a harder thing to do because you're not just guessing what will happen next. You're actually making a decision. What do I want to happen next? And so to me, that's the essence of reinforcement learning. It's about, another way I describe it sometimes is evaluative, like learning from evaluative feedback, right? So in supervised learning, you learn from supervised feedback, which is, here's a problem, try to answer it. Okay, here's what you should have said, right? This is the supervision. This is what you should say. Next time, learn to do that better. But in reinforcement learning, you don't get that kind of signal. You do something, like the learner does something, and then the feedback that it gets is 4. You know, it gets like some kind of numerical score, and its job is to try to figure out, how should I produce outputs from these inputs to maximize that score? And so in many ways, it's a much, much harder problem, right? Because you're given less direct information. But in other ways, it's much more generally applicable because you don't have to have that supervised data to be able to apply these ideas.
So the logical question is, why is it that reinforcement learning has become the pork of machine learning?
The pork of machine learning. why is reinforcement learning the pork of machine learning? I think in part because, yeah, it's funny. Because I want to say it's easier to apply in the sense that it's more generally applicable, broadly applicable. You don't need as much input, but it's harder to get it to actually do something useful. So whereas we could probably, the two of us could sit down and list like 50 really influential applications of supervised learning that touch people's lives on a daily basis, I can only think of maybe three ways that companies have used reinforcement learning in a way that's really visible, that you can point to it and say, yeah, they did that using reinforcement learning and that was the right way to handle the problem. And so why is that? Part of it is because it's often somebody quipped once, I heard an AI researcher say that you can tell when you're listening to a reinforcement learning talk at a conference because the x-axis in terms of training data is in exponential notation, right? It generally takes millions and millions of trials for these systems to actually learn how to grapple with the environment to try to maximize reward. And it's not a necessary feature, but it is a very common feature of these kinds of problems, that there's it's such a big space of possibilities that as the system starts to explore and try things out, there's just lots of different things it has to try before it can really latch onto a successful recipe. So a classic or very notable application of reinforcement learning was the system that learned to play the game of Go well. It's also been applied to other games like chess and Gomuku and Hex, various kinds of board games. But the program learned to play Go at a level that was possibly better than any human has ever played the game. But to do that, it had to play more than a human lifetime worth of games, right? So if you were born and all you did was play Go, sometimes take a break for lunch and sleep a little bit each night for 70 years, you would not play the number of games of Go that this program played to learn how to do well. Now, arguably, that's still incredible that a program could do that. But in terms of sort of practical applications, you often don't have 70 years worth of experience before you can actually make good decisions. Most applications don't have that.
Other than playing Go really, really well, what are some of those other real world applications that you mentioned that you'd thought of?
Yeah. So one of the ones that I think is very cool is a system that I think that was in the Nest thermostat. So basically a smart thermostat, a little computer that is controlling the temperature in your home. It actually learns the thermodynamics of your house and then uses that to maximize reward. So it starts to understand, if it knows what the outdoor temperature is because it's on the internet and it's getting that data. It knows what the indoor temperature is because it's got a thermometer built into it. And it knows that, okay, well, I ran the cooling system, say, for this amount of time at this power level. It can start to figure out, okay, well, this is how long it takes. This is how much energy you have to put into the house before it is cooled down this number of degrees. And once it kind of understands, once it's able to predict accurately, this is a supervised learning problem in a sense, right? Like if I put in this much energy and the temperature is this and the outdoor temperature is this, this is how the temperature is going to change. So over time, it actually does this kind of internal supervised training to be able to predict the temperatures. Then it takes an additional step that says, okay, if I'm trying to, it needs to be set to, oh, I want to use Celsius because you're in Australia, but I don't know what, but then I was going to say, you know, you want to set it to 80 degrees Celsius. And I'm thinking, okay, that's actually probably survivable. So you want to set it to some, you know, to, let's call it room temperature. You want to set it to room temperature. And so it knows what the target is and it knows the way that your house changes in reaction to turning the cooling on. It can then optimize, it can then maximize reward, which is to say it can find the way of adding the least energy to the system to bring the temperature to the right temperature in the shortest amount of time. And so it does this planning, it does this sort of reinforcement learning step of deciding on actions that are going to change the world to try to maximize a score. And the score in this case is a combination of comfort and energy expended to reach that level of comfort. And I just thought, man, that's brilliant, because it's actually what's wonderful about it is, unlike the Go example, in Go, it trained and trained and trained and trained. And then finally, what came out at the end is what's called a policy. It's basically, here's a decision rule for playing the game. And at that point, it doesn't need to learn anymore. It basically like, it doesn't matter that it was created with reinforcement learning. It's this brilliant policy for playing the game. So the reinforcement learning is now, it was just like behind the scenes, like a parent sort of like, you work really hard, and finally the kid's out in the world and then your job is done. What's neat about the thermostat case is that when the thermostat ships from the factory, it still needs to learn. It has to get into your house and learn about your house. And so the learning is actually part of the deployment of the system itself. And I just think that's super cool, right? So you have a system that's learning to do a good job with your data on the fly. And not just, we used reinforcement learning because we couldn't figure out a good policy without it. This is like, no, it has to be deployed with learning in it because your house is different from my house, is different from her house, and different from his house. And so that particular application I really love. And they did it in a way where it learns, you know, in a week or so. It doesn't need to take a million trials before it learns what to do.
Are there any other products or software tools on the market that do anything similar to that, to your knowledge?
Maybe. So I don't know too many of them. It's possible that there's some of this stuff is happening behind the scenes. I know that Google will sometimes brag that they use various kinds of reinforcement learning in their data centers. So it's similar to the thermostat question, where you actually want to keep the data centers at a particular temperature. You don't want to use up a lot of energy to do that. I think it's typical that a data center will use half its energy on cooling and half its energy on compute. And so if you can save energy on cooling, you've got more energy left over for compute, which is the data center's job. So you really want to, you know, do the best job that you can with that. But if you let things get too warm, computers start to fry, they start to break down, and then you can't get the compute done. So finding the right balance of like, okay, how warm can I let it be right now? Or if I cool it for a while, can I actually let it warm up for a little bit without danger that the machines are going to break? And so there's this kind of oversight process that's watching all these readings and deciding what to do. And my understanding is that some companies are using reinforcement learning to tune that policy, to tune that rule for deciding when to turn on the air conditioning, what sections of the data center to air condition at what times. And so
I could imagine a similar application with exhaust fans in tunnels. So that wouldn't be heat, that'd be just power exhaust needing to be cleared, but it's basically the same sort of thing.
Yeah, so basically reinforcement learning is about, it's what engineers used to call control theory. It's about trying to decide what to do, and you have some measure of goodness of what you're doing. Classical control theory looks at a very constrained version of the problem where the rewards are all about, you know, distance from a target, and you have to, it's like squared distance from a target, and the dynamics of the system are all assumed to be locally linear and so forth. But under those assumptions, you can just apply a control system to it and it does the right thing. What makes reinforcement learning distinct, I think, from control theory is that we're very comfortable saying, oh, we don't know if it's linear or not. We're just going to use a more general function approximator. Oh, the rewards don't have to be any kind of specific distance function. We can handle whatever. And it's true. Like in principle, it can learn much more complicated, much more rich environments. But then there's this trade-off because then it learns much more slowly. And so you want to use control theory if you can, because it's going to learn more effectively. It's going to be more robust. But if you can't, we got some other tools for you.
How do you see the use cases for reinforcement learning changing in the future?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So it strikes me that the current boom in machine learning, in machine learning that we've been seeing over the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of it was enabled by the fact that we just have a lot of data now and we have enough compute that we can crank through that data. To the extent that we're starting to instrument control systems more, like if you have lots of temperature measurers in your house and lots of different vents that can be controlled by computer, the more that happens, the more there's an opportunity to actually do some control in the real world. The more that it's not like that, right? That you take very rare readings and then a person interprets those readings, like what you might see in an intensive care unit in a hospital, a lot of it is not fully instrumented. The assumption is that people are in the loop, writing things down in charts, making actual decisions, and it's not measured. And so it's really hard to then take that data and do anything with it. The more that we are just for other reasons, we're more naturally connecting up sensors and storing that data, the more opportunities we have to just like, oh, wait, we could actually apply learning to this. The same way that companies that were collecting all this data on the internet for other reasons said, oh, wait, we can actually You know, we collected all these photos on social media because people want to share photos. But wait a second, now we've got a million photos. Well, what can we do with a million photos? So I feel like that could be the future of reinforcement learning, that as the data sort of organically is being gathered, then there's going to be an opportunity to actually use that data to make some smarter decisions.
So things like smart electricity and water meters, telematics, sensors in mines, all those sorts of things could potentially be used for reinforcement learning modeling.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. Yeah. And you see the company, the industries or the sectors that are doing more of that, the opportunities are going to happen sooner.
I can totally see that happening in something like the mining sector, which in Australia is just massive. From what I've heard, they've got sensors that are gathering data every second or something.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I definitely have heard of like large, you said massive, like massive vehicles that are actually part of these mining operations, just moving things around. And so to the extent that, so even just deciding I'm going to move this pile of stuff from here to here is incredibly expensive. And so systems that are trying to reason about, well, what's the benefit of that compared to the cost are going to be really valuable.
I was at a conference last year where there was a man who was talking about optimization problems in the mining sector. And there were things like, how do you optimize the fuel use by getting the drivers to drive at a particular speed and things like that? And I could imagine that could become a reinforcement learning problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's perfectly set up for that.
What about things like generative AI? Because I've heard reinforcement learning was used in training ChatGPT, although I'm not exactly sure of how it was used.
Yeah, that's a really good point to bring up. ChatGPT is amazing, and it's amazing how it really caught so many people's imaginations. And one of the things that's really cute about it is, if I were teaching an intro machine learning class today, I would very much lead off with ChatGPT because it uses unsupervised learning to understand the pattern of word usage. It uses supervised learning to try to generate outputs that are more consistent with like target outputs. They want it to produce language in a certain way, not just whatever kind of flows through it, but it should be like a conversation. And so to do that, they actually train it with some supervised learning. And those supervised learning systems, it actually is learning to say, okay, if this was the question and this was your answer, human beings would score that as a 4. You know, whereas here's the question, here's a different answer, human beings would score that as a 10. Supervised learning is used to learn that mapping. Then now we have a reward function and we can apply reinforcement learning. And that's what folks do in a application of RL that's called RLHF, reinforcement learning from human feedback. So instead of a defined reward function, like you get 8 points for or whatever, we're gonna charge this much for fuel. We're going to give you this much benefit for mines, quantity stuff brought out of the mine. Instead of a human being writing down what that sort of price list is, they have human beings, human judgments. It learns to match these human judgments. And then it trains itself for a long time trying to say, okay, how should I generate outputs so that the supervised learned reward function that says whether a person would probably like this or not, it will be happy. And it makes a tremendous difference because if you actually look at what these language models do before they're trained that way, they just output all kinds of nonsense because they're not really guided in any way. They're just trying to predict, in all the web pages I've ever seen, what's the next token? But instead, now they're kind of tweaked, they're tuned to produce outputs that are judged to be the things that people like. And that's done using a modified form of reinforcement learning.
I'm just imagining something like the gymnastics at the Olympics, where at the end of someone's act, you've got the judges holding up the cards. It's basically what you're describing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's how I think about it, is that's evaluative feedback, right? You're given a score. Now, if you were a gymnast and you were trained by going to competitions, doing something, and then at the end of it, you know, looking at the cards held up and say, huh, I guess I should try something different next time. Other people got bigger scores than me. Then that would be pure reinforcement learning. Of course, athletes, gymnasts are not trained just that way. They're given a lot of supervised data. They're given a lot of unsupervised data. They're given an opportunity to just play around. They're given verbal guidance from the coaches. But at the end of the day, yes, they're trying to figure out how to behave to get that score up. And that is at root, that is the reinforcement learning problem.
Another example we had when I took not your machine learning class, but another course, machine learning for trading, we actually used reinforcement learning to come up with an optimal trading policy. Is reinforcement learning actually used in practice for developing stock market trading policies?
That's a great question. That's a tough one to answer, because the folks who do this, they'll only tell you about the stuff that doesn't work well. Because if it's stuff that does work well, they're going to use it to make as much money as they can, as quickly as they can. So I think Tucker Balch, I think, was the professor of that class. And he ultimately left Georgia Tech to work at, I'm blanking on which one it is, but it's one of the major financial companies in New York City. So he's actually doing this stuff now. Is he doing it with reinforcement learning? I don't think he's going to tell me, but it is perfectly. I mean, I was talking about the mining example, where you have to figure out, okay, there's fuel usage, there's time to deliver the ore, there's how quickly the ore is coming out. You have to somehow make a scoring function that brings all these different things together. What's great about financial trading is there is a common currency. All the decisions you make, it's really a question of maximizing currency, like getting the most money that you can. You make a trade, it costs you something, but then there's a monetary benefit from that. And those are exactly comparable to each other, right? It's all, I want to say, dollars. And so it's a beautiful, and you also have to make sort of temporally delayed decisions. Like I'm going to buy this stock now, and only later is it going to pay off if the stock price goes up. And so you're making these decisions with possibly very delayed effects, kind of like a game, like a board game, where I'm going to move this piece now. I'm only going to find out at the end of the game whether I actually won. And I still have to figure out, okay, was that a smart move that I made 20 moves ago? I'm not sure. And so it's a beautiful example of reinforcement learning. Are they actually doing it? They're probably doing some interesting mix of ideas. Whatever works. The people who work in these trading companies, they're very adept at bringing together all the ideas that could possibly come to bear. They're not purists, right? They're not like, well, I'm going to do this because mathematically it's the right thing to do. They're like, no, we're going to mix these things together in whatever way is actually going to make some money.
And given the profits they're making, they've clearly figured out a way of doing it very, very well.
That's my impression.
In addition to your work as a university professor, you've also written a book, Code to Joy, which I'm actually really looking forward to reading once it's released. And that's, I believe, coming out on the 3rd of October.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. It's something that I put a lot of effort into. In fact, I spent a good chunk of time visiting Georgia Tech last year, and in all my spare time, writing. Now, I'm excited that you're excited about it, but you might not be the target audience, because it's really introducing some of the ideas of computation to people who aren't already familiar with them. So the goal of the book, Code to Joy, is the idea of, like, if we all could code a little bit, we all might be a little bit happier. And so let me tell you about what the fundamental kind of components of programming are. Because the emphasis in the whole book is how we tell machines what to do. How do we go about getting computers to do what we want them to do? And I think of that as being connected with, sort of happiness, in the sense that if you want the computer to do something for you and you can know how to tell it to do that, well, then you're going to be happy, right? You don't have to depend on other people. You don't have to just like make do with what is already doing. You actually have some say in the behavior of the machine. And so I go through all the different components of computing, and I relate them to real world things that I think everybody can relate to, because I think these concepts are not foreign. Like, people design programming languages on top of the way that we already think about the world, and we already think about language and communication. So I think it's not as foreign. I think a lot of people think it's scary and like mathematical codes and stuff, but the ideas are actually ideas that we all use day to day when we're just explaining things to each other. And I also relate each of these concepts to some idea in machine learning, where the computer is actually helping to create that computational concept. So I talk about if statements, conditionals that we use in programs all the time. I relate that to the word if, like the fact that people use this all the time. They think about lots of things in a conditional form. I talk about the different ways that if you were to try some of these things out on your own, it could empower you to make home automation and automated storytelling and all sorts of things that people can do right out of the box. And then I say, and this is kind of like in machine learning, decision trees, right? Where the computer will actually write the if statements for you, given the right kind of data. And this is how programs can actually write code, essentially, by learning from data. And so each of the concepts all have their kind of companion machine learning concept, because I'd want people to understand that it's not magic. It's actually, it's powerful and it's useful and it's empowering, but it's not incomprehensible. It's a thing that we can all use to make our lives better.
That's actually really cool. Even though I know that I'm probably not the target audience, I still want to read this book.
Well, that makes me very happy. Thank you for saying that.
I can see it as being something that would help me to explain a lot of the things that I use to others.
Oh, well, that's, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. So I should market it to computing professionals as well. Like, if you got to explain this, steal my explanations. I worked really hard on these.
Yeah, exactly. Most academics, when they write books, they tend to go for writing a textbook targeted at either an audience of their peers or at students so that they can use that to teach a future class. What made you choose to target a general audience?
I think it goes back to the story I already told you about my siblings. Like, I think something in me, even though I've concluded that I'm weird and not everybody loves this stuff, part of me still wants to try to make the case. Part of me still believes if I could just explain it the right way, everyone would be as excited about this as I am, because it's just so cool. They're just blocks of sand and metal, and they can kind of think, right? You can kind of coax them to do things like a human brain. And it always just made me so fascinated to know that you could, if you just, it's almost like classic wizarding, right? Where you say magic words and then things happen. The magic words are code, right? You actually can come up with the right incantation. If you say these words in this order, things are going to get sorted. Or if you say them in this other order, it's going to be a machine learning program. Or you say it in this other order, it's going to be a computer game. That's like borderline magic to me. So I think that's part of it. So that's the personal story. The less personal story is, I really do think that because computing has reached so many people, like one of the ways that computing was able to reach so many people is by making it so you didn't have to code. You didn't have to be a computationally minded person to be able to get the benefits of a personal computer. So that's great, or a website, or whatever it is that you're interacting with, cell phone, right? So that's great. But to get it into everybody's hands, they had to hide a lot of that expressiveness, right? So some of the power had to be hidden. And I think what that does is it puts companies who are producing that code in a position of unusual power, because they get to control what you, all of us, get to see and interact with. And many of them are very responsible with that power. Some of them are not so responsible with that power. And I think that it has put us into a situation where we're kind of at the mercy of these companies to do the right thing. And some of them aren't doing the right thing. And I think we need to kind of take some of that power back. And we're never going to be able to do that unless more of us can actually talk to these machines, tell these machines what we actually want them to do. And I think that could actually really change the whole dynamic between the way that human beings and society and machines and companies all come together, hopefully more productively.
Why I look at it, if you were going to a foreign country where you don't speak the language, you would learn some parts of that language just so that you can interact with the people in that country. You know, just hello, how much does this cost? Where is the restroom? Things like that. You know, the basics. And I see learning some programming as being a lot like that. You know, you don't have to be fluent in a particular programming language, but you need to know just a little bit of it, just so that you can interact with the natives of this foreign land, which happens to be computer land, where the natives are phones and computers.
I love that. That is a great analogy, because it also points out, I mean, if you're feeling a little paranoid, right? Imagine that you go into one of these foreign countries and all you've got is like a local who's going to be your translator. And every interaction, you have to go through that person. If that person is trustworthy, everything's fine. But if that person wants to exploit you, there's not much you can do about it, because they're telling you, they're mediating, right? All your experiences are going through them. And, you know, I hate to say it, but I think some of these companies have been doing that with us, that they get to decide that we're just going to take your data and we're going to sell it to other people. And they're going to change your worldview. They're going to expose you to different things than you'd be exposed to, because we can, because we're in control. And so, yeah, I love that. Like, the more that you can actually say hello, goodbye, how much does that cost? The more that you even know what's possible in that culture, right? The less you can be exploited by people who have that knowledge.
Yeah, and you don't get in the taxi ride from the airport where the taxi driver convinces you that it's $1 million to travel from the airport to your hotel.
Right, right. And you've got no recourse whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I do really think that that's important, that the people not treat this as some kind of black box, not because I really think that it's important that everybody program all the time, but because it holds the others to account, right? It means that they can't treat you like a commodity, because you're a person with your own opinions and feelings and preferences, and you get to express them.
People need to know enough about computing so that they can make informed decisions. They don't have to be able to be a software developer, but they need to be able to make informed decisions that, you know, it's just like with investing your money. You need to know enough finance so that you don't succumb to a scam.
I think, yeah, no, that is brilliant. I think that economists refer to this as the principal agent problem, where the idea is that there's the principal, there's you who actually want something, but you're working through an agent. And if that agent is at all corrupt, then you're stuck, right? But on the other hand, if you were going to do it all yourself, then you don't get the benefit of an agent who actually has more expertise. And so what do you do to actually kind of navigate that relationship? Yeah. And I love that you said that we don't, it's not about making everybody a software developer. This is a battle, not maybe battle is the wrong word, a disagreement that I've had with some of my colleagues who study programming languages and computer science education, where I'm a big fan of Scratch. This is a programming language that's all very graphical and blocks that click together. It's really quick to pick up. It's often taught to kids, but I actually think it's great for everybody. And I say this in front of my professional colleagues who say, you're dumbing things down, you're making things worse, you're going to create a group of people who really have no business writing code, because they view it as ultimately the purpose of writing code is to become a software developer and actually write code that other people are going to use. And so it's almost like the debate that you see sometimes with people who teach literature, right? Where they'll say, well, we have to teach them everything. We have to teach them how to be great writers, because otherwise they're going to be terrible writers. It's like, no, but everybody needs to learn how to use language to get their thing done. Even if they're not going to be authors, even if no one's ever going to read their stuff but themselves, they still need those skills. And so things like graphic novels, right, which you might poo-poo as like, well, that's not real literature. Like, yeah, but it's still people using language, and it's helping people understand how to express things in language better. And I guess I view languages like Scratch as being a little bit like graphic novels. It's like not the best way to train a software professional, but for the rest of us, it's fine. It's a great way of getting those concepts, being able to express yourself and connecting with the process of telling machines what to do.
I sort of see it as being like, I don't know, do you do any art like painting or drawing or anything like that?
Not good. But I like to make like visual puzzles. Like I like to take photos and manipulate them, and then it's like a thing you have to figure out.
Okay. Well, if you go to an art supply shop, they will have different ranges of products. And, you know, with paint, there's always the student grade paints and the professional grade paints and something in the middle. And a person who wants to learn to paint does not buy professional grade paints, because you get tiny little tubes that cost a small fortune. You buy these student grade paints, which are good enough to get the job done, and then you can make a mess and all that. And a lot of people will never graduate beyond student grade paints, but they're learning how to paint. They're getting the joy of painting whatever it is they want to paint. And, you know, there you can have multiple markets for things, and there's no shame in buying the cheap student paints.
That's great. So, okay, so now here's how people might push back in the software case. They would say, okay, but that's a waste, because you're going to learn bad habits with the student paint, because it's different from the professional paint. It just acts different. So you're like training people to use this one thing, and then you have to untrain them and retrain them to do this other thing. And that's just a waste of everybody's time and energy.
But you could also have a situation where, I know when I was a kid, if I had something really expensive, like, not that I ever had the professional grade paints, I think I had just student grade paints, that I would have been too scared to use it, because I would know that I wasn't good enough to use it, so I would just be wasting it. Whereas by actually having something where I wasn't scared of running up a massive bill, I was able to get to the point where, okay, I will never get to that professional grade paint level, but where I knew that I didn't want to go to that level. And it might have led to a different decision. I might have decided I should go to that level.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. I do find it really interesting, though, that that's the argument that the software people will make. They'll say they're going to learn bad habits that we're going to have to train software engineers out of. I guess they don't see the hobbyist as an end goal, right? Whereas in art, you could certainly have people who are like, look, I'm never going to like sell my paintings, but it really makes me happy to every month or so to sit down and paint a landscape, right? And I think that there's not a recognition among a lot of software professionals, a lot of educators, that some people just want to have that as a skill, even if it's not something that they're leaning on professionally, that there's benefits to being able to do this short of making your living this way.
Just thinking of another example of that, that's a counterexample to the strictly purist approach, I guess. Did you ever read any of Raymond Smullyan's puzzle books when you were younger?
I did, yeah. Yeah, the Logician, right?
Yeah, the Logician. So yeah, he had all these, he went in for those, the truth teller and the liars. So you had to ask people questions and figure out if they are truth tellers or liars. And they had a copy of one of those books in my local library. I think I borrowed it about 20 times. I have read it so many times. I have my own copy now. I spent so much time reading that when I was a kid, and I did not understand logic at that time. But 12-year-old me managed to muddle my way through logic really badly and probably learned all sorts of bad things, and that would have had to have been retrained out of me at some future point when I did maths or logic or computer science. But I still learned stuff, even if I learned it badly.
Right. And you built up some kind of conceptual foundation that the other stuff is that you're still using today. And you liked it, right? Like you felt motivated to continue in that area. Whereas if we had like hit you right off the bat with, no, we're doing mathematical logic, we're going to do Gödel's theorem, but we're going to do it in gruesome detail, you would have, many of us, not maybe not you, but many people would have just like, no, I'm off the bus now. I'm getting off. This is not a ride I want to take. And so there's tremendous benefits to that. But I think there's a bias in computer science, a really strong bias against waste, right? There's a sense in which everything has to be completely efficient. If you have to redo something a second time, that's an error. And I get that as a design goal, right? So like when you're writing code, you don't want to write the same code in multiple places where it's going to be hard to maintain and you're not going to get it right each time. Like you want to keep things, say that the one thing, the one time, the right way, and don't waste any cycles on anything. But the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of fields that don't have that as a design goal. I watch like TV production people, and it just blows me away at how much stuff they throw away. Because when you map out a movie, you make the entire movie wrong once. You do it like on paper, sometimes with audio and music and special effects. It's like it's the storyboard version of the movie that people will watch to make sure that it kind of flows. Then they throw it all away and they replace it with the real stuff. And I look at that and the computer scientist in me cringes. I'm like, no, they need a tool that where they design stuff, they design it on the computer, and then the same things are reused again, just pasted into place. Don't throw anything away. That's crazy. But the fact of the matter is that is how they do it. And they do it that way for a reason, right? That there's actually value in throwing things away as part of the process. And I think computer scientists we have not embraced that as a design goal. We want to do it once and never do it again because that's perfection.
In the National Gallery in Victoria, there is a massive painting that's like the size of a whole wall, you know, two-story high wall, that is some famous artist's rough draft of a picture. I mean, this guy painted something that's probably, you know, 3 or 4 meters tall by 5 or 6 meters wide, as a rough draft before he did the same thing again. Well,
That's awesome. Yeah. And I don't think that bothers artists, right? It's like, yes, that's how you do it. And again, as a computer scientist, even though I'm making the case that we should be embracing that. Oh, I can't. I just can't. Like, no, do it once and then project it onto find a way to reuse that work, because otherwise you're just wasting energy, you're wasting effort. You know, big O of log n, not big O of n squared. Sorry, that's not a generally accessible joke. But the point is, shave off all the waste. It's got to be as bare bones as possible. And maybe we need to embrace a little bit of waste.
Do it the first time to get it to work, and then the second time to get it good.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously you have just said that you think Scratch is a good first programming language for people. Once they move beyond Scratch, what programming languages do you think are the most accessible to people?
I mean, everybody's using Python for everything now. So Python is obviously a huge juggernaut. I feel like when I was younger, when I was, you know, just starting out, there was always this desire, there should be libraries. We should be able to build on each other's code. But then everybody who was anybody would not pay attention to other people's libraries, because if you didn't write it yourself, you didn't really understand it. You didn't really know how to use it. And it probably has waste in it. We know how we feel about waste. So I feel like Python somehow finally got people past that discomfort with libraries. And now you can really embrace it. It's like, okay, I wanted to use the Hungarian optimization algorithm. I don't have to implement it. I actually found a library and I called it and it did what it was supposed to do. It was awesome. So I do feel like Python has done a really good job with that. I just had lunch because, you know, I guess I'm a nerd, but I had lunch with somebody this past weekend and he was just regaling me with his love for Rust, programming language that you can't make pointer errors in. Like, that was what he was super excited about. I'm not so worked up about pointer errors in general. Like, maybe that's just not the kind of code that I tend to write. But boy, he was like, I wish I could start all over again because I would just learn Rust. So some people feel strongly about Rust. Julia is a language that to me looks beautiful. And I want to program in Julia just because it looks like the way I want to think, but I've not learned Julia. I did teach one class, a reinforcement learning class, in Julia, not knowing Julia, because the book used Julia. And I think all the students ended up doing everything in Python anyway.
What's your go-to language of choice?
I have been known to use Scratch for things that I need. Like, sometimes I want a thing that's going to beep every 5 minutes, because otherwise, like, sometimes when I'm working, I feel like, okay, I have a tendency to either stay on the surface and not really get anything done, or go deep, lose track of time, and then like piss people off because I was supposed to be doing something else. And so having something that just wakes me up, just like every 5 minutes brings me back into the world, and I know that I don't have to keep track of time, like, that's actually tremendously valuable. And so what language would you write that in? So I wrote it in Scratch. It's two lines. It's like, wait for, you know, 60 times 5 seconds, then make a meow like a cat and just put that in an infinite loop. And it was like super fast. It did what it needed to do. And I didn't have to think about it. It was, yeah. So sometimes I'll use Scratch, but if I'm actually getting things done, it's Python.
Yeah. Most people who I've interviewed on this program seem to be Python fans, which is possibly saying something about the guests I'm choosing more than.
No, I don't know. Cause I've, as you know, you took machine learning class with me and Charles. Charles, one of the things that's amazing is that the assignments in the machine learning class are, we don't care about the code. We want to see what the machine learning algorithms do. We want you to talk about the output of these machine learning algorithms. And the students are like, well, what language do you want me to write it in? And Charles says, I don't want you to write it at all. I don't care what language it's in. You can run a library for all I care. This is not about you implementing the code. This is about running that code and understanding the output. People are like, yeah, but it can be Python, right? So students just, first of all, they have a difficult time imagining that a computer science teacher would not care what language they use. And second of all, almost everybody uses Python. It's the rare student who doesn't end up using Python. So if you're saying you're taking weird guests and that's why you're getting a biased sample and everybody's Python, I think it's most of the field. And that's your bias right there. You're choosing people in computing. R's great. I do stuff in R sometimes.
I like Python. Python's my first choice. But at the moment, I'm doing a project that is using a lot of stats that are psychometric statistics. And the Python packages just aren't that great because all of the research psychologists use R. So I've actually written it in R because the best packages for it are in R. But for everything else, I'm going to go back to Python.
That makes total sense to me. Yeah. I mean, the reason I picked up R is because early on in my career, I shared an office with a statistician. And whenever I was like, but how do I do this? I want to make this kind of picture. I want to make this kind of graph to put into paper. She would just like bang it out in R really fast. I'm like, yeah, I should probably learn this language. It was also a lot. The first language that I was ever formally taught. So I did a lot of self-teaching in high school and so forth. Then I got to college. I took a computer science class. The first language was APL. So I don't even know if you know what APL is, but it's this crazy language that is kind of, if you ignore the surface appearance of it, which looks, we used to say, it looks like line noise. It looks like the what a computer does if it's spitting out random characters, because it's all crazy, overlaid characters, funny Greek symbols. It's not, you need a special keyboard to type it. But it's basically R, because the way that you're supposed to think about the data structures is you do operations on the entire data structure. If you write a loop, you've made a mistake. You should never write a loop. You should always be acting on the data structure as a whole. And I feel like that's how R wants you to write things too. You don't want to write loops in R. You want to write operations that hit the data structure all at once. You know, add these two matrices together, boom. You don't loop over all the positions and add the corresponding components. You just like add the matrices. And that's how APL tries to get you to write code.
I worked for an organization that had some critical code that was written in APL, and they paid someone a lot of money to translate it in from APL into SAS, which is what a lot of insurers use, because they were scared out of their minds that all of the APL programmers would either retire or die, and then they would never be able to use this program ever again.
Yeah, and we used to say in the class, APL is a write-only language. Like we learned in the class how to express really complicated ideas in these crazy overlaid symbols. But then if you even look at your own code, certainly not anybody else's code, you look at your own code, and you're like, I have no idea how this is doing what it's supposed to be doing. It was like completely uninterpretable because it was, you know, things were acting on other things. Like you try not to put conditionals in there. You just hit these operations against the data structures. It was very messy too. And I could see why translating it to some other language is probably a really good idea.
Yeah. Is there anything on your radar in the AI data and analytics space that you think is going to become important in the next 3 to 5 years?
To whom, right? So, I'm really excited about this. Well, the topic in general, as I said, of my book, which is about telling machines what to do. These large language models that can kind of help you program are absolutely fascinating to me, because you can kind of describe what you want in words and then code comes out. Nobody's sure exactly how they do it, but it doesn't seem to be by really understanding, like internally constructing a formal specification and then translating that into code. It's something about the way people talk about these processes in natural language that they know how to translate somehow into working code in a flexible enough way that it's not just cut and paste. It actually is kind of regenerating it around the problem that you've currently got. I don't know where that's going. It's scary to use it because if you don't know how to code already, it generates code for you that you can't understand, and it may or may not be right. Like it can be a little bit off. And I think part of the reason that it's off is because it's really hard to tell machines what you want them to do. It's hard to tell people what you want them to do. And part of the way that we actually do that in practice is by having a conversation. Like I'll explain something to you and you'll be like, what do you mean when you say such and such? And then I can explain that piece. And you're like, but what happens if these two things happen together? And I'm like, oh, actually, you're right. I should have said that differently. And then, so we'll have a back and forth until you feel like in your head, you have a runnable version of that. I see programming going that way, that it's we'll have a conversation with the machine where we express what we want, but then the machine comes back at us with, but is that really what you mean? Or if that's what you mean, wouldn't this weird thing happen? Like really being able to try to infer the intent. And I think one of the dangers of the current systems, these systems that you give them natural language and they spit out code, is that they make very strong guesses about intent. They're going to, whatever you say, they're going to try to induce some kind of intent and then write to that intent. And if they don't understand the intent well, they're going to be wrong. And they're not going to actually match your intent. They don't really reason about, wait a second, what could you actually mean by that? They just make a guess and they go with it. And this is kind of like the hallucination phenomenon in ChatGPT, where it'll make stuff up. This is like, I don't really understand your intent, so I'm just going to make something up. And that's bad when you're actually trying to convey something to a machine, because you don't want it to make stuff up. You want it to be in line with what you want.
My experience with trying to get ChatGPT to write code is every time I've done it, it's come back with incorrect code. And I think this actually is making the case for your book, because I know it's incorrect because I can code. But if I couldn't code, or at least didn't know some code, then I could theoretically just take that code, use it, and then get the wrong results.
Yeah, you're totally right. And I think that observation is really important, because there are people who should know better who are out there saying programming is dead. Like, we don't need to. It's almost like I was talking about before, when many of the students left computer science because, like, you'll never need to program. That's all going to be handled by people in another country. Now people are saying, you don't need to learn how to program because it'll just be handled by a large language model. And I'm thinking, that's just wrong on so many levels. First of all, the language models are not going to be able to debug themselves. And second of all, even telling another person, like even expressing what you want in natural language to a machine, requires the ability to conceptualize what it is that you're trying to do. And that's a skill that programmers have to learn, but we all have to learn, because we all are talking to each other and trying to, you know, convince people to do things for us. That's not trivial. Yeah, I just don't buy it. I don't buy that this is going to somehow become magically easy, because it's not even easy to talk to people.
I think it'll just take programmers and basically turn them into the managers of robotic workers.
Yeah. And if you've ever taken any management classes, which like everybody should do, because at some point you're going to be needing to tell other people what to do. It's not trivial. And communication is so important. Like, you need to understand, what is the other person seeing? How are they interpreting it? That back and forth is not a trivial skill. And you're right. Ultimately, that may be what programming is, that we're delegating our tasks to these machines, but we have to have kind of a relationship with the machines to make sure that they're doing what we actually want them to do.
And what final advice would you give to data scientists looking to create business value from data?
There are no shortcuts. I feel like that is the most important message, is that I think a lot of people who haven't really gotten their hands dirty with data and really like learned how to be a data scientist think that it's just easy, that there's just, you have data, you have a problem, we're done. And the fact of the matter is, there's no shortcuts, that you have to engage with the problem in a really deep and fundamental way. And if you think that's wasted effort, you don't understand how hard real problems are.
One of the lessons I learned when I was doing my PhD, I tried to cut so many corners in there. And every time I cut a corner, it came back to bite me. And I ended up having to do the whole thing again from scratch, the whole proper way. And it's like, if I had just done this properly to begin with, I would have been finished by now. So it taught me a valuable lesson in not cutting corners.
Yeah, no, that is... That is a good lesson to learn. And I think that a lot of people need to learn this lesson. I think that we're going to be hearing more and more over the next couple of years from the big tech companies, like, no, we're going to magically solve all your problems for you. And one of the mantras that I tell myself is, if a problem is hard enough that you need AI to help you solve it, or data science to help you solve it, then it's hard enough that AI alone and data science alone is not going to be able to solve it. That you actually need a kind of partnership that involves really deeply understanding the actual problem and these mathematical and computational tools. There's just no way around it.
So for listeners who want to learn more about you or get in contact, what can they do?
Sure. Yeah. So I have a Twitter handle. I think as of today, Twitter is still a thing. Who knows? It varies from day to day. And I have a website and I have a podcast. And so if people want to hear, you know, me and a colleague of mine, Dave Ackley, kind of talking about computation and sometimes interviewing some really interesting people, welcome to join in for that.
What's the podcast name?
It's called Computing Up. So the person I do this with, Dave Ackley, he studies artificial life. And so he's really interested in the relationship between computation and intelligence and life. And so from his perspective, everything sits on a computational foundation. And so it's computing up, like everything else is just on top of that.
I will put a link to it in the show notes.
Thanks so much.
And thank you for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure. It was great conversing with you. I'm really, really happy to get to talk to your audience. And it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
And for those in the audience, thank you for listening. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and this has been Value-Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting.